Welcome to this It's Just Politics edition of Issues and Ales, looking forward to the November election. Mm-hmm. And is everyone looking forward to the November election? Are you looking forward to the November 8th or are you looking forward to November 9th?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 21 days, 1 hour, 18 minutes. 34 seconds, but who's counting? We want to welcome our guests to our right, not necessarily politically speaking, though. We have Matt Marsden, Republican strategist.
And a guru of Rev6 strategies, who understands political numbers like almost no one else that I know, and who also wins the prize for longest drive.
Oh yes.
So if this were like a high school reunion, you know, Matt would be going home with a parting gift.
If anyone has a couch that he can sleep on tonight.
North Oakland County is a long way from here.
It is.
And then to Matt's right, again, not politically speaking, is the chair of the Democratic Party here in Michigan, Brandon Dillon. So a big round of applause for these two gentlemen who have decided to come. And I will just quickly say, with a little asterisk when we introduce guests, that for a sitting chair to come to an event like this, I think is saying something. As Matt, to drive this far, you as public radio listeners.
Kind of a big deal.
Well, it's a big deal, and I think it also shows what it means when we talk about getting community together like the olden days and talking about democracy and how to fix things. We're doing that right here, maybe with a little more beer and having a little bit more fun, but I think this
Beer's
is democracy
good.
In action. So I'm very glad that everyone could be here tonight. Mm-hmm.
As our motto goes, drinking beer and talking politics. What could go wrong?
Right? It's like Thanksgiving dinner. You're right after an election. It's a great idea to talk about whether the election was rigged or not.
Now, I do want to talk about local politics here because we have one of the most competitive state house races.
We do.
In the state, one that could help determine control. Two. Say. Well, which two, Brandon Dillon?
That would be the 61st District and the 66th District, which is mostly Van Buren County, but does come into Kalamazoo County as well. So
before we jump into that, this is a question that I have, because one of the things we talk a lot about during presidential elections, of course, everything gets talked about the top of the ticket. How many folks here actually know the names of the sitting representative in the 61st and the 66th right now? Okay, so two out of the room. You know what? That is two fewer than zero. Two more than zero.
I saw a third.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you want me to tell you about
Let's not do campaign literature, but why don't you throw out their names? Why don't you say who they're running against and what the main issue is right now in the 61st?
Well, the current representative in the 61st is Brant Iden. He's running against John Fisher, who's a Democratic candidate, and the current representative in the 66th district would be Eric Nesbitt, who's term limited.
It's
an open seat with Annie Brown, who is the Democrat, and Beth Griffin, the Republican.
And in 2016, as again we've all been talking about the presidential election, here in Michigan, though, one of the really big issues that we're following as political junkies, of course, is control of the state house. Chair Dillon, obviously, we are being recorded. I think right now I would say to you, so can you win back 9 seats? And you would say, absolutely, we're working really hard to do it. Really, right now, though, give me the odds. Can Dems win 9 seats to take the house?
Well, I think if the current numbers hold at the top of the ticket, yes. I've said all along that we needed Hillary Clinton to win by 10 points. And if she wins by 10, I think we get very close to the majority.
I haven't seen a poll yet where she's winning by 10, though.
Detroit News has her up by 14 head-to-head and 12 in a four-way.
Yeah. Oh, okay, you win.
Yeah. Well, on average, it's been between about 9 and 11, but the Detroit News poll said 14. So, Matt, as a Republican, and I want to dig deeper into the Trump effect and what it means for moderate Republicans or even conservative Republicans but still aren't jumping on the Trump bandwagon. Talk to me about, do you see that same issue as the Trump effect at the top of the ballot pulling down these House races? How scared are you that we could actually see Dems take the House because of Trump?
I think in the last 2 weeks, there's been an epic shift, and I think the I-94 corridor from Jackson all the way to Kalamazoo over to Van Buren County, I think those House races are the ones that you're going to want to watch to see the trends of how this race is going to shift. And, you know, I'm not going to sit up here and say that That's about all I can say.
Get this man another beer. Let's hear what he really wants to say.
It is going to have a tremendous impact.
It's going to be a huge impact.
Huge. He's impacting the ticket. He's heavily impacting the ticket. He's not just heavily impacting the ticket both in the state house races, but I think you're going to see two congressional seats that are going to come into play here, and that's the 7th congressional seat and the 8th congressional seat. And, we know that Tim Walberg took the seat from Congressman Joe Schwartz in 2006 and turned
around. Your old boss.
My old boss, yep, a good moderate Republican fine man. Who's not supporting Trump, who signed the letter along with the others to say that he wouldn't support him. But what I think is going to end up happening is that you're going to see a repeat of a shower potentially in the 7th, where he took the seat from the Republican, then lost it in 2008 to Mark Schauer, and then turned around and won it back again. Mm-hmm. But even with a redrawn seat, those areas of Lenawee County and Adrian and Tecumseh and some of those spots, when it comes to issues, they swing. And in these, and I think that's what's interesting about the Kalamazoo seats is that they have a history. Van Buren, Kalamazoo, Battle Creek, they shift. And Kalamazoo County is probably by far, from a data standpoint, one of the most significant, uncanny barometers of how the state will ride in terms of the presidential election. How Kalamazoo goes, so goes the state of Michigan in terms of the presidential politics.
And how presidential politics goes, so goes Kalamazoo.
That's correct.
Yeah. So, Rick, I want to turn to you in just a quick second. I'm doing what we call in radio a forward promote, what we're going to get to really quickly. I want to talk about something that happened today and has been kind of bubbling over Wendy Day and the issue with Republicans. But first, I want to go back and talk a little bit more about swing districts. I just got back from up north where Lon Johnson, your predecessor as chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, is looking to become the Democratic congressman since Bart Stupak, so quite a few terms since. He is running. It looks like polls are actually showing that he could be neck and neck with Lieutenant General Jack Bergman. I was up there, though, and I mean... 3 to 10 saw signs for Bergman instead of Lon. Here, based in Ann Arbor, I was starting to think that maybe Lon was seeing some momentum, that the first could actually go back to a Democrat. But I'll tell you, being up there, man, it is conservative. And maybe it's just the yard signs and anecdotal evidence. But talk to me a little bit about what you're seeing in the first right now.
Well, it's definitely neck and neck. And I think Lon is probably a little bit ahead at this point. I'm sure Matt will agree with me on this. If yard signs were the barometer of elections,
there would be a lot
of people elected who currently aren't. But I think the most important thing is who has the most TV time up there. That is a district that you just cannot. It's the largest district east of the Mississippi. It's 37 counties in the state of Michigan. You have to be able to be on broadcast.
You got to be crazy to run for office there.
You have to be a little bit nuts.
Matt Marsden just called Lon Johnson crazy.
They're all crazy.
Crazy in a good way. You have to be able to, I mean, and he is.
Crazy as a fox, Bergman's which Lon Johnson too. Hunts. He does. He has guns.
And he's outspending him on TV significantly. And I think I think you may have been in some different parts of the first, because Lon is obsessed with lawn signs too. And there's a lot of them in different pockets of the first congressional.
Lon's very good. He's a good campaigner. I mean, he knows what he's doing. That's the other thing. And you've got kind of a guy that came out of the woods in a way. Nobody saw him coming. So I think that you do need to give a little bit of credit to what Lon was able to do in terms of his absentee voter registration while he was chairman, and the fact that he has spent time inside the Obama campaign and understands the data side of things. So, I think that he probably has a little bit of an advantage in terms of his infrastructure.
So I'm going to tell a little story. There's no kids in the audience here, right? I just want to make sure. So you said Lon Johnson likes yard signs. Do you know why Lon Johnson
likes yard signs? He believes in name ID.
So when he was running his first race,
I don't even know if I want to get involved in this.
His sign said Lon Johnson.
There was some vandalism.
Went around adding a G to Lon.
I asked him once, I hope his middle name isn't Greg.
And the sheriffs went and took down the sign.
And Lon goes, no, keep the sign.
Put them back up.
So that's my off-color humor for the night.
But
public radio isn't always PG rated.
So, but here's another thing about the first congressional district is that Lon Johnson is a pro-choice candidate, which should be just the death knell north of Clare. He has strong connections to Detroit, which should be the death knell north of Clare. He is literally sleeping with the Obama administration because his wife is Barack Obama's fundraiser, or was when
Social Secretary Juliana Smoot.
Mm-hmm. But he has a better NRA rating than Jack Bergman, and that makes a big difference in the first. Between that and the TV airtime that you're talking about, and the fact that the Johnson organization seems to be superior to the Bergman organization, I'm just talking about pure get out the vote. That could make a difference up there.
Well, he certainly is an incredible organizer. He's intense. He doesn't let any details slip by. I can tell you, I probably got four emails from him since we've been sitting here telling me what he needs and how much help he's doing. But, you know, the residency issue, I think Republicans tried to make an issue out of that because they wanted to say Lon wasn't from the district. But that's really been tough to do since his opponent has spent the last 6 years of his life living in Louisiana. So that's kind of taken that off the table. And, you know, I don't think being pro-choice or pro-life is as important as the issues of hunting and the Second Amendment up in that district. And Lon certainly, for all his work ethic, he finds time to fly fish. He's extremely knowledgeable about those things, and it makes a difference when you're talking to people up there.
Yeah. Okay, so quickly, Rick, give us a little update on the news story of the day here in Michigan, Wendy Day, and then I want to open it up to questions, which will just kind of make sure that throw up your hands when you've got questions. We could talk all night, but I really want to hear what you all have, what you're wondering about, things on your mind, as my guess is these two gentlemen to my right do too. But Rick, first fill us in on sort of the news story of the day.
The internecine warfare in the Republican Party continues as it appears that the Michigan Republicans grassroots vice chair, Wendy Lynn Day, who is a Tea Party leader, who won the position at a Republican convention last year to be basically the state party's liaison to the Tea Party movement, either has been or is about to be removed because she will not support Donald Trump at the top of the ticket. She is saying that, you know, people can vote straight ballot, that you know, they can vote for the rest of the ticket, but she will not. And under Republican Party rules, if you are openly not supporting a nominee of the party, then you're out. And so
how's that big tent Republicanism working for the party right now, Matt?
I think the big tent has been dead since 2004. I mean, the Tea Party's part of the problem the Republican establishment has, and I'm not one to ever back away from the fact that part of the problem that Republicans are presently having is born of this obsession with allowing certain elements of the Republican Party to control it. And really, infighting right now, I mean, this is not a good situation for the GOP, and that's my opinion personally, politically speaking, and professionally. They've got problems, and now they're going to make those problems even worse by fighting with each other over stupid shit. I mean, it really is. It's dumb stuff. What good is this fight doing right now other than to drive the personal consulting efforts of the individuals that are getting in the pissing match with the chairwoman of the party?
But Matt, you and I were talking about this beforehand, and what goes on at Republican Party conventions, and which is that the old guard, the traditional Republicans, basically don't go to conventions anymore, which means that changes who gets elected to these party positions. What's in the party platform?
Yeah, for everybody out there, I mean, a picture from a consulting or a political standpoint, there are really two different sides of this, right? There are people that kind of focus on convention politics, and it's a very different form than your primary races and your general elections. Convention politics are floor fights that are won in ballrooms and in hotel hallways and places like that, and there are people that make a good living off of being focused just on convention warfare and convention politics. Then there are guys like myself and others and the chairman here who focus more on the big elections that happen in presidential years and in off-presidential presidential years and in primaries where we're talking to the voters and we're trying to communicate a message. So, you know, I can't speak so directly to the convention politics because that's not really my bag. I haven't really gotten involved in it. But yes, to your point, Rick, that's what allows that cycle to continue to repeat itself, because the same nuts are doing it over and over and over again. And at some point, there's going to need to be a change given, or you're going to continue to have candidates that don't win general elections that come out of the conventions. And that's a problem for the GOP.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's open it up to some questions. Or you want to say something, Brandon? Well,
I was just going to say, I thought it was very, you know, Wendy Day is certainly no closet liberal.
No.
I mean, she is extremely conservative.
Yes.
And I think this is the first time that this has ever happened in the Michigan Republican Party. And at a time when, you know, people like Dave Ajima and others were tolerated for some pretty awful things, that the first person that they throw out is a female activist who has pretty sterling conservative credentials.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, let's open it up to some questions. Enough of us for right now. Who's got questions, comments, issues?
Over here.
Question right here.
Over there.
Okay, here first.
You're going to win because you're closer to Steve Kropinski.
Uh-huh. My name's Don Bolthouse. I'm wondering if our primary process is broken, and if it is, how could it be fixed to yield better candidates?
Mm-hmm. Well, can I ask you, why do you ask the question? Why do you think the primary process might be broken?
I can't believe we're saddled with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. It's just amazing to me that those are the choices.
Well, and this goes to the idea, right, that in primaries, you're going to see the folks who decide to turn out tend to be either the super conservative Republicans or those who are really passionate, or a party of Democrats. I'd love to hear from Brandon. I mean, what do you say to that, to folks who feel like Bernie Sanders didn't get a fair shot? Of course, Bernie Sanders, who won Michigan. I mean, what do you say to folks who just feel like the primary system isn't working because we have these two candidates that let's be real,
that neither one of these has broken 50% in any poll that we're aware of.
Right, unfavorables in years.
The alternative, though, is to go back to the way it was before you had open primaries, where party bosses,
the smoky dark rooms
in the back, chose which candidates were going to be the standard bearers. I mean, the reality is, on the Democratic side, this is, I think, the first time that you've actually had a primary go all through to all 50 states. And it was clear that Democratic primary voters chose Hillary Clinton and Republican primary voters chose Donald Trump. I mean, I think it's much easier to blame the two candidates and the choices, but I think people need to understand that the alternative is just to have actually no public input and let the parties operate as totally independent actors and choose which people that they want to be representing them, as opposed to actually having voters decide it.
I think that's one of the problems that you're looking at right now from a general election perspective, going from the primary, is that we're seeing in our numbers tremendous apathy amongst voters, obviously for these reasons that you just cited, sir. And the problem with that is that for the GOP, on the GOP side, we're seeing a significantly higher amount of people that are just really upset and disaffected and apathetic. But I raise that point because that's the problem with the primaries. To be honest, if we're going to be blunt about the primary system, the problem is you got to remember to go vote on August. I mean, I know that the date is bad, and nobody wants to think about it when they're on their summer vacation and whatnot, but, I mean, participation in primaries amongst a state full of 7 million registered voters is abysmal, and so you get what you get, right? And for on the Trump side, he'll continue to make the claim, and from a data political science standpoint, he's right. He garnered more of a Republican votes than any Republican presidential primary candidate in modern history.
Yep.
I don't know how to explain the psychological status of that in terms of the American public, but the numbers are what the numbers are. I think that the reality of that choice has become far more clear as the campaign has poured on.
Yeah.
But it happened, and people voted for it, and that's democracy, folks.
And I'll say, too, just as Steve's making his way to the next question, I think there's something about, for folks in this room now who have that question, but, you know, you're out, what, on a Monday night right now with fellow public radio listeners talking about politics. You're like 0.0001%.
Maybe a little lower.
Right. Sorry. So for us in here, it's going, you know, we're going to tear our hair out. But let's look at, you know, we are a microcosm right now. Okay, we've got another question. Oh, yeah, well, way in the back. But then let's get to this young woman here in the white.
Hello, my name's Jason.
Hi, Jason.
Three questions, and they're involved with the beer industry because we're at a bar right now. Number one.
Oh, my.
A local representative has proposed legislation to expand the wine and grape council.
The beer tax, okay, yeah.
No, that's Hooker's bill's dead. That's not going to be here. But the Wine and Harvest Council is a real thing for Southwest Michigan. Right now represented by agriculture and retail. How do you feel wine and beer connects with the economy and how it connects with the state of Michigan and how it's creating an identity for the state of Michigan?
That's amazingly.
Well, hey, that's a great question. Actually, let me just jump in because being
Why don't we let him get through two and three really quickly?
I'm sorry.
So,
well, number two is a federal level, which is when are they going to start a federal proposal for legal 19 drinking age and support that and take the decriminalized people that aren't criminals and make beer and wine a part of our society like it should be?
Three.
Number three is the defense of 0.08 and to go back to 0.1. And the feds want 0.05, and it won't support this place. It won't support anybody, and it needs to go back to 0.1 because that's reasonable, and it makes beer and wine a part of our society.
Okay. We're going to ignore the last one just because I don't think that any of us are really in a position
to let me just say, I was a state representative, but I don't do policy anymore. So I try to stay away from the issues, help elect people, and then let them make the decisions. But I do the first point of your question, I think, is absolutely right. Southwest Michigan, West Michigan, Grand Rapids, where I'm from. I mean, this is becoming a big
portions
part.
Of Northern Michigan.
Portions of Northern Michigan, Detroit, everywhere is becoming a big part of the Michigan economy. And I think to the extent that, you know, legislators from both sides, I think, recognize it. And you're going to have to work them over because, frankly, you know, as long as they have a Democrat by their name and they're not as crazy as Donald Trump, I'm going to support them. So that's
no, but I think that the craft beer industry and the reputation that it has made it a political force.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I will go back to the whole thing about all of us being together tonight and the 0.00001% of the population. Like this is part of our society, right? And if we can do this and enjoy ourselves and have a beer or two while we're talking politics, why not? I don't think the four of us at the table are going to be able to answer that question.
See, I've always been opposed to the name of this particular event. It's Issues and Ale.
We believe it should be called Issues and Ales.
I believe there's...
Yeah, we've been trying to get Steve to change the name forever.
We've proposed an amendment. It's on the table.
This woman here has like had her hand up.
And there is no tax like a sin tax.
Thank you.
Hi.
My name is Kelly Height.
Hey, Kelly.
And on my drive over tonight from Ann Arbor... I heard about...
Did you get stuck
you drove
in that
from
traffic
Ann Arbor?
Outside of Parma too?
Parma, yeah.
Oh, I know.
You
I,
almost
f-
beat me.
8 minutes.
Mine was 8 minutes.
14 minutes.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. It's okay.
Well worth it, though. But so my question is, I was listening to NPR and hearing about how voter registration for this election has been higher than it ever
was before. 7.5 million.
Yeah, so my question is, how do you think this impacts both the polls for the state of Michigan in terms of likely versus registered voters, and how it will impact the outcome of the presidential election?
Matt,
I think that's a Matt.
Yeah, you're the numbers dude.
You know, there's a lot of numbers that are floating around, whether it's, you know, 10,000 new registered voters is probably a little bit closer to accurate. Some folks claim there's 7,000 registered in East Lansing. The reality of the matter is that the only barometer that we have right now by which to judge that is the absentee ballots. And right now, as of Thursday of last week, we have about 867,000 absentee ballots that have gone out. Okay, so what that puts us at is roughly a little bit ahead of 2008, slightly above our 2008 numbers, but we haven't reached the 2012 numbers, at least from our Rev6 data systems analysis of it. So what we're going to be coming up to soon here is what we call a net loss period, where we've got more ballots that are coming back in than we do have ballots that are out. So it's one thing to register somebody to vote and to Lon Johnson, again, credit, when he was chairman, he put on a very aggressive program to register new absentee ballot voters, and he did a great job of doing that. But the lesson from the from a democracy standpoint is they weren't able to get them back in again, right? We signed up a bunch of new people, but we didn't get them to actually take the absentee ballot off the counter.
And they tried. There was like a phone app.
They've tried a lot of apps. And listen, at the end of the day, a knock on the door or a phone call really on these things is the only way it's going to work. Apps and technology are great, but a lot of the times they fail in the field. And you see a total collapse and a failure in the field, and then people are wandering around streets looking at their phones, trying to find a house that supposedly has an absentee ballot, and they never find the house.
When really they're just playing Pokemon Go.
That's right, they're playing Pokemon Go. And they're getting credit for doing their door-to-door time, I suppose, if they're a paid
they're like,
staffer.
Wait, we got to go to the house to the left.
My point is, I think you can. Sure, there's been more registered voters, but what we're seeing back from the generic ballot tests and some of these polls is that there still is a level of apathy amongst those traditional voters who are just frustrated. Frustrated by the choices, frustrated by the situation. And, you know, the other thing that's going to play a big part in this is that you're going to see these guys like Gary Johnson and the Green Party that are, you know, people are going to say, well, I'm angry, but I'm going to participate, but damn it, I'm going to vote for Gary. And how is that going to impact things?
Stein and Johnson are not going to have GOTV, get out the vote.
Neither is Trump. I mean,
it's the state Republican parties. It's not his, and it's not going to be the legendary Barack Obama operation that was called knock and drag, where they identified every voter in every household, and in the last hour before voting was done, people were knocking on those doors going, come on, we've got a car.
Well, driving busfuls.
Well, they set a new standard in terms of how they use data. I mean, Barack Obama's people set the benchmark for that. So to the chairman's point, Mr. Trump hasn't invested in any of that kind of infrastructure. You know, he's relying on his Twitter account and he's relying on his media.
That may be the death of Jack Bergman in the first district, too.
It could be the death of a lot of them.
You know, Matt's absolutely right. The Obama campaign kind of revolutionized the data, but the Clinton campaign, I have to tell you, is incredibly sophisticated. They have every single voter modeled in this state. And, you know, our numbers that we're showing.
Well, except that every party thinks that they do have every single voter modeled.
I haven't heard. I will tell you this. We are, I think, maybe Matt's firm is the outlier, but I think our data operation is still miles ahead of where the state Republican Party is or the national Republican Party. And what we're showing in our absentee ballot returns is a little bit more, maybe a couple days off, but Republicans seem to be holding on to their ballots. Democrats are returning them at a much higher rate than they did in 2012, which I think is indicative of this kind of apathy that you're seeing generally. Democrats aren't overwhelmingly excited to vote like they were in 2008, but proportionately, it is significant. Well, and that is, I think, what will ultimately determine things like the state house and Congress, whether these people show up or not.
And I was talking to a gentleman who's a pollster who said that they have what's called the enthusiasm scale, right? And that actually, and this was a few weeks ago, I mean, this was before the latest Trump scandals and the latest email leaks, but this was that just there was an enthusiasm gap between Democrats and Republicans. Normally, the scale is somewhere around a 9. Right now, it's kind of low 8s, but there's actually like a 1-point difference between Republicans and Democrats, and that can change an election, right?
Enthusiasm is down overall.
Right, but that Republicans are
Democrats,
still...
But Republicans are more unenthusiastic.
Yeah, and I think that there's some numbers that suggest that where Hillary Clinton is right now is significantly higher at 12 points. Let's say 12 points, where Barack Obama was at 9 points in 2012. So here you've got a significant shift. And I'm sorry, when you've got support of 24% of the women in generic ballot testing in terms of the presidential candidate being Hillary Clinton versus Trump, I mean, 54% on average of females participate in every presidential election year. So you've got right there, that is a monumental issue. You can't piss off 24. I mean, you are going to be in trouble, and it will impact down ticket races.
Well, in general, you don't.
No, you don't
want to
in general, but you really don't
want to
take it as far as we find ourselves today.
Okay, let's go to some more questions, Steve. Yeah.
My name is Brian.
Hi, Brian.
I live in Vicksburg. Just south of here. In a state where we typically elect two Democratic senators, often vote for a Democrat for national office, where's the disconnect at the state level where there's been really no growth? I mean, there might be some coattail this time, but I mean growth on the local candidate level that leads to the state house and the state senate.
Gary's
Well, it's gerrymandering, but Brandon Dillon, isn't it also a problem with Democrats that you can't get your voters to turn out in midterm elections, which is when we as Michiganders vote for governor, secretary of state, AG, and in 2018 for the state House and state Senate?
Yeah, it's both. I mean, for instance, in 2014, I was working in the House, and we said, oh, as long as we don't get a 2010 turnout, I think we'll be okay. We'll pick up a couple seats. Nobody anticipated, no modeling, no polling anticipated that we would do worse than 2010. We did worse than 2010, but we actually got 51% of the vote statewide for Democratic state House candidates. So the combination of Democrats not turning out in those off-year elections combined with redistricting has been a lethal combination for Democrats since 2010. I think 2018, when the governor's office is vacant again, you'll see a much more competitive race at the top of the ticket, which can help. But this is a problem we have to solve. We have a rising group of voters, but they are not as committed in off years as Republican base voters are.
Why are Republicans more committed
so
voters
damn good
than
at voting?
Democrats?
Well, I think that there's a certain base percentage point, and I think you could take the 61st Kalamazoo seat to take a look at that. Maybe it sits as a 54.2% Republican-leaning seat, right? But when this current incumbent won, he won with less than 50% of the vote because we had a Libertarian that took away some of the percentage points, and hence why it's in this toss-up category right now. So Republicans, there are a core of Republican voters, and I'm not a psychologist. I'm a political science guy, so I can't explain it. But these are people that will vote. The base vote will vote for the Republican regardless of
no
whether or not
what.
It's Trump. It's just I don't have a direct answer, but it's a percent of that base. Now, if this candidate here in the 61st chooses to use his delegate status with Trump to try and drive the base, maybe he's got a chance. But if not, if the women turn out to vote, he's got a problem. But there's a percentage of Republicans that will vote Republican straight ticket every single time, and they'd never miss an August primary, and a lot of them are 60 plus and older.
But Democrats
getting older,
straight ticket voting more often than Republicans. That's why Republicans fight so hard to kill.
This is kind of a recent phenomenon. If you go back to the early 90s and the 80s, Democrats used to do better in off-year elections than Republicans did. And I think it's because of the changing nature of the Democratic base. We have become more diverse, less reliant on white working class union voters. And some of those have migrated over to the Republicans based on social issues and some other things. They're just more reliable voters to turn out. We would win, President Reagan would win, and we'd pick up Congress
but
in every
why?
Other year. Well, I think it's a demographic issue. I think it's a certain people, as they're older, they vote more, they understand the consequences of voting, and we have to really drive that home with our millennials, African Americans, Latinos, the people who are just entering into the system, and just see the presidential race and get excited and then forget what goes on in the off year.
And life moves. I mean, things change. Issues happen. Events happen. Economic conditions change. You know, new things happen, right? I mean, we evolve every year as we move forward, and different things and issues affect people's passions and their hearts and how they want to go places, and people can shift. And really, the question on this election and other elections all along the way, and really I'll tell you who is the worst at participating that needs to get involved in this, are what we at Rev6 call the ticket splitters, right? These are people that can vote for Barack Obama and turn around in my neck of the woods and vote for Brooks Patterson, Republican for Oakland County Commission, and then turn around and vote for a Republican judge, and then turn around and vote for an all-Democratic school board.
Well, it's how Gary Peters won in 2014.
Right, that's just how they are, and that's a psychological thing. That's not anything that we can just slap a simple answer on. It's just how people feel at the time.
Yeah. Which is so much what we know about voting, right? That emotional response. As much as we like to think about it as something deeper than that, a lot of it has to do with emotions. Okay. Yes. That way.
I had a question relating to the media with...
Oh, great.
Hey, thanks for coming tonight.
This was so fun, you guys. Let's do this again.
With the woman for, I believe it was The Guardian, who was reporting on the Native American protests.
Oh, Amy, wait, are you talking about Amy
now?
Goodman?
Yeah, who was...
Yeah, Amy Goodman.
Rioting.
From Democracy Now. Yeah.
Yeah. She was just been charged with rioting. And with Peter Thiel, who just got Gawker shut down.
Yep.
Who now is supporting Donald Trump with I don't know how many million.
I think Hulk Hogan's responsible for that.
Right. Yeah.
You didn't watch the tape, did you?
Do you feel that there's any attack on the media?
I've seen the way the media gets caged in at these Trump rallies, so I'll let you answer that question.
I mean, it's a difficult question to answer, because part of the answer is, well, yes, of course, but that's also part of the deal that, you know, you're out there and you're reporting and interpreting, and people are not always going to like the facts that you turn up, the interpretations that are turned out there. And it's a very, very difficult job to do well. It's an impossible job to do perfectly.
But as a former press secretary for a number of elected officials, these individuals have a job to do the same as I do, right? And my job in the function of a press secretary, at least in the time that I've done it, was to make sure that we were able to provide them with as much as we possibly could that they were asked for, right? And open.
And Matt and I never, ever, ever clashed when he was the press secretary for the Senate Majority Leader.
Well, you know, we've known each other since the 1990s. Maybe a clash here or there, but I think that there are approaches.
That's my point.
Right, yeah. I mean, all these guys, if you treat these individuals in the press corps, they're doing a job. Your job is to give them the information to answer the questions to provide to the public. Don't be a jerk off and shut them down or pen them up. If you got a tough question, you answer the question. Sometimes you don't put your candidate in front of them because it may not be able to answer it in a way, because part of that's damage control. But you, at the end of the day, your job in working in service to people that are elected is to make sure the press has the questions and the answers that they want, and that they have the access that they need to do the story, to inform the public of what's happening. And that needs to happen more often in politics. And I think that this particular election cycle, we've seen a big downward turn in that.
So I will get on a soapbox. I'm like looking at my watch right now with the second hand, 45 seconds. As the program director at Michigan Radio, I run a newsroom and programming department of about 32 people, give and take. That's salaried daily folks. There's also like 8 interns. So let's say 40
people. She plans down to the 10th of a second.
I do. So we're at 38 seconds. You just wasted 4. I'm adding that to myself. Every single day I go into Michigan Radio and see some of the smartest people, the most big-hearted, caring people who think about you every single day that they walk into the newsroom. It's not about their egos. It's not about what they can, you know, like throw at Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. It is purely about what everyone here in Michigan needs to know. I think the Flint water crisis is an example of that and what our reporters did. So when you say, do we feel that, you know, we're at war with people, do we feel, well, sure, there's people who are lying to us constantly, including a governor's administration who just flat out told us lies about things this past year. I like to try to think about the good from people when I'm trying to get questions. I think our newsroom does the same kind of thing. So Amy Goodman, I think she was doing something that she felt was helping her listeners and her audience. Did she step too far? That's for the public to decide. That's for a judge to decide. And luckily, we live in a country where we get to do this, right? That we get to sit out here and say, like, damn you, Snyder administration, or go, Snyder administration, or Hillary Clinton's a liar, Donald Trump. Like, the fact that we get to do that is pretty amazing, and it's an amazing job to get to do. Sometimes it's scary. Lately, sometimes it gets scary. But overall, I mean, I think it's a good thing. And yeah, I mean, sometimes we get in trouble doing it. Sometimes folks don't. But that's how I would answer the question. Just that, is media under attack right now? Sure. Isn't it always? Yeah. But you have a lot of strong people who are doing good and feel really passionate about it and will continue to do it. So. Oh, right. And for $5 a month, you too can make sure that you're doing your part. And every dollar does make a difference. Funny. You're funny. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Next question.
All right.
Yeah.
The name Johnson came up, and I'm just feeling like a lot of people these days are like, okay, Democratic, Republican, and I think nobody's happy with the choices. But as Republican and Democratic supporters, why do we feel like we're only have the two choices when there are so many other choices out there that are neglected to be spoken of?
You mean third parties?
Let me answer.
Yeah, two
party system.
Yeah,
well, let me just be very brutally honest.
I have an answer too.
There is absolutely no way that you are ever going to see in this country where you have elections that are plurality wins, majority wins, winner take all, that you are ever going to have viable third parties. The only way you can have it is in a parliamentary system or in a system where you have proportional representation. There is just no way that a third party, every third party that's ever had a flash in this country has been based around a large personality.
Except for Jesse Ventura.
Jesse, but he was the Ventura. He won, and then they went away.
Maybe.
They started the Reform Party. If you remember, Donald Trump almost ran as a vice presidential candidate. It is the nature of the system. The two parties, if they see one somebody taking on an issue, will adapt themselves to take it. The two parties may change. They may change forms. They may rely, but you will never have a third party, viable third party option in this country because the electoral system, and I tell people all the time, stop pretending that it's going to change.
I would throw in with that culture is a powerful thing. And that the culture in this country, it seems like, you know, almost since the founding, we've pretty much always had two parties. So that's the way that it shakes out. But the other thing is that what we found is that and Brandon's absolutely right, that third party and independent candidacies seem to be built around strong personalities, and then those evaporate once those strong personalities exit the stage. And if they bring in particular issues, then if they're powerful enough and the public is buying into it, then one or both of the two major parties will typically incorporate it into their platforms and what they're doing. So it's not that third parties are irrelevant or uninfluential. They don't necessarily elect candidates or a lot of candidates, and certainly not presidents and a lot of members of Congress, but they don't lack influence either.
Ralph Nader, Ross Perot, Gary Johnson, all of these three people will have an impact on the election by peeling away 1%, 2%, 6%, 8%, right? It can impact a race, especially like the one that we're talking about here before us right now. So while they don't win, these third-party candidates may, in tight races, pull off just enough percentage points to impact the outcome. Al Gore, ask him, right? others. So they do have a weird function in this process.
Although
still,
the question I would really have is it really a vote for Jill Stein? And is it really a vote for Gary Johnson? Or is it just a vote out of saying, I am so tired of the other two? Nevada, there's the vote, you know, remember they tried to do this in a couple smaller districts where you could do the regular votes and then there was like the no vote. And they tried this on a ballot. It wasn't statewide. And, you know, like, don't you think the Gary Johnson and Jill Stein right now are much more about a no vote than they are voting for any of those policies? Because actually, when you read some of the policies, you know, maybe you are for them. That's fine. But you know, you have a Jill Stein who's against vaccinating. I mean, that's not what a majority of Americans think. You have Gary Johnson who believes we shouldn't be giving monetary aid to any countries. Probably not what a lot of Americans actually think we should be doing, that some countries should be getting money. I mean, isn't it just a no vote rather than any vote for any of the actual policies that these two people are saying?
Matt Marsden will remember Leon Drillet, who introduced a bill that said that the election ballot should include a none of the above.
Yeah.
As
right.
a vote
you
for
laugh,
the...
But
one
I mean,
of his many brilliant
what?
Ideas.
Isn't
but
that
that's also not the way democracy works, because someone will wind up. You don't get to vote for none of the above because someone will wind up in the office.
Well, the other thing is, too, the third parties, you know, I've had discussions with many in the Democratic Party who a few of them said, oh, I'm voting for Jill Stein. She's just pure on the issues. You know, you have the luxury of being pure on every single issue when your goal is not to actually win an election. Mm-hmm. When you're just wanting to make a statement, you can be as ideologically pure as possible. But both parties, to a certain degree, are built to win elections, and you have to have big coalitions. The Democratic Party has extremely different members in different aspects, whether you're talking a rural farmer in some area up in the UP with a resident of the city of Ypsilanti. I mean, they have nothing in common except a certain set of core principles. And that's why I think the third party, it is easy for people to say, oh, it'll be better off. Let me just ramble on one more time.
No, second beer.
Everybody says to
get me, this man
wouldn't
in the
we be
beer.
Better off if Joe Biden was the nominee or someone?
everybody seems better until they actually have to get in and get the crap kicked out of them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, very.
You know, here's another interesting phenomenon that people of a particular age, by that I mean mine.
Thank you, good sir.
Will remember the time when, you know, we talk about bipartisanship and cooperation. But we recently went through this anomaly in Michigan and American history where the most liberal Republican was more liberal, and I'm doing a visual thing here, so sorry if you're listening to this, was more liberal than the most conservative Democrat. That there was a real crossover there, and that made a difference in how issues got resolved in Congress and the legislature.
And I also think that there is an element in the voter modeling, if you are in our Rev 6 system as a ticket splitter, that's somebody that usually is passionate enough that will look and say, okay, out of seven out of the last nine presidential elections, this individual has gone and voted in November for a presidential candidate. They didn't vote in the off-gubernatorial years. Maybe they voted in a couple May school elections, but this is a person that is driven by whoever they are internally to participate. Sometimes when you find with these voters, they go in and they just can't personally stomach voting for somebody, say, at the top of the ticket, right? But they've got five or six other people down the ballot that they do support. More than likely, that trend leads to local elections, countywide races, school board races. So they go in because they feel a civic duty that it's their job to vote, but they just can't bring themselves in good conscience to vote for the person that may be listed there. So they pull the trigger for somebody else like Gary Johnson or somebody and say, well, I went in and voted, and I got everybody else in, but I just couldn't do it. And that's, again, a human element of the voting system.
Here's another human element, which is, remember, and now it's almost run the opposite way, but the voter who couldn't, even though Michigan is one of the few straight ballot voting states where you can go and just make one mark and the entire...
We'll see about that.
Oh. We'll see.
Yeah. Actually, a friend of mine said that if a meteor hit Michigan, two things would survive.
Straight party
voting. One would be cockroaches. The other would be straight party voting.
Well, if I could just one thing on...
And maybe Law and Johnson.
On straight ticket, which is a point I think my friend here would agree with. I never understood the logic of that, because really, from a demographic standpoint, when you're looking at straight ticket voting, in terms of finding out demographics that impact redistricting and redrawing lines, straight ticket voting by a precinct allows companies like mine to sit and say, okay, we know we have at least a base of 4% diehard Democrats and 6% diehard Republicans, because they go in every year and they pull the straight ticket ballot. It helps to understand that, to know that. That's an important thing, because that is a committed party member, and you want to have that if you're going to redraw lines in a fair way and avoid the gerrymandering that came up earlier. What's fair, what's not fair? That ability to read that straight ticket voting, while it has great election rights things, I'm not going to get into that part of it, but from a political science part, straight ticket breaks the voters. We see a big difference areas on straight ticket voting. So from a data standpoint, I love straight ticket voting.
Well, let me just, the issue, the woman that asked the question about the two parties, I think there is a legitimate frustration, and I think it's because nothing gets done, right? You look at Washington, it's gridlock. You look at Lansing, well, a lot's gotten done, but we don't, on the Democratic side, don't necessarily agree with what's happened. But I think the biggest issue, and Matt touched on it, is it really is, and this is probably because of the more sophisticated data, the redistricting. I mean, there are 12 to 13 competitive state House districts out of 110 this year. Everybody else's election was handled in the primary. And the system in this country was set up not to just... The assumption was not that everybody is this purist and is out to do the public good. It was to balance the interests of people's desire for public service with their desire to get reelected and promote their own self-interest. Well, if your self-interest is to get elected in your primary, you are ultimately going to make decisions that appeal to that primary base on both sides. So I firmly believe that the best way, the simplest way to actually get better results is to have districts where people's competitive election is in the general election, which forces them to move to the middle and actually talk to people on the other side. There really is no incentive for a legislator in many districts to do anything other than appeal to either the right side of the electorate or the left side.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to some, yeah.
And straight party balloting is good.
Hi.
But sometimes it's okay to vote for people. You know, sometimes there's an R next to somebody's name that's a good person. Or sometimes there's a D next to somebody's
coalition
name
vote.
That's a good
person. Well, the issue, the mythology that's been out of there, too. I mean, this is not a requirement.
Right.
Nobody is required to vote the straight party. Right. You can always split your ballot. And, you know, Michigan, I mean, I think there would be a lot of people who would look at, okay, well, maybe we could get rid of straight party balloting if Michigan actually had early voting or no reason absentee voting or some more election reforms that made it easier for people to vote. But I think, 50% of the people in the state vote straight party. They do it for a reason. They're not stupid. They align with one of the two parties and feel that they don't want to have to take the time to educate themselves about every township clerk and school board candidate. They use those cues.
Although it seems like in the 70s and the 80s and maybe into the 90s that there was always that you know, person out there who just as a matter of pride would always, you know, even if they were basically a partisan voter, would find some reason to vote for one person in the other party or independent because they just couldn't abide the idea that they were a straight ticket voter. And now it's kind of the other way.
Yeah, Milliken. Hi, Rusty Smith. With news items about the supposed fracturing of the Republican Party, to what extent do you see that happening in Michigan? And is it at a grassroots level or party control level? And what issues and values might provide a focus going forward?
Matt, you want to take that?
Well, I certainly don't work for the Republican Party directly, but I can say that the fracture is really going to end up coming down at where you look at some of these congressional races that are going to be impacted by some of the decisions made by the Trump campaign and how that plays out. I think that if you were to ask, I spoke to Congressman Bishop last night, and I think that he's feeling the impact of this and has conveyed the fact that, you know, 2 weeks ago in a district in the 8th, which is, you know, should be fairly strong, that he sees the impact of the top of the ticket impacting his race in the last 2 weeks and understands that there's not a lot he can really do about it. I mean, I think right now we're watching the Democratic National Party start to do ads against Congressman like Mike Bishop that are tying him to Donald Trump. They're going to put that anchor around him, even though he's not endorsed him, even though he's not done this, that, or the other.
Actually, he has endorsed him.
Well, the tape says
he has endorsed
he's a,
him.
He has not rescinded
that endorsement.
Right. Well, rescind it then. Fine. He's not.
He has not rescinded that endorsement. He has endorsed him. He will not rescind that endorsement.
He sent a letter out condemning his comments in regards to.
Well, he condemned his comments, but he is still endorsing him. He is the nominee of the Republican Party.
Regardless, the strategic perspective is that the Democrats, and I think he'll agree, the plan here is to tie Donald Trump around the neck of every single person running for office, and whether that trickles down to these House races, that's what they're going to do. And it's not a bad strategy because he's given them plenty.
You know, look, I ran for state rep in a year where I was the only Democrat that won in a competitive race in 2010, and I can tell you, I didn't know whether I was running or if Barack Obama was running for office that year. It was at a time when he was extremely unpopular. It was after the passage of the Affordable Care Act. It was very difficult to escape that trend. And, you know, without giving away too much, I wouldn't be shocked if you see candidates at the local and congressional level being linked to the top of the ticket because, frankly, it's an effective way to make sure that people understand what these candidates stand for. And I would, you know, just, I think the what Trump is also doing is really hurting these candidates by talking about the election being rigged. I mean, there is no better way to depress turnout than to tell people their vote doesn't matter. And I, for the life of me, can't understand why he's doing it, but I don't have a problem with him continuing to do so.
Well, because, I mean,
No, but you are speaking to a particular phenomenon that many years ago, a Democratic U.S. House Speaker, Tip O'Neill, said all politics is local, and that has been absolutely turned on its head.
That was like the 1980s.
Well, it's also when you had local,
and they want their politics back, man.
It's also when you had local newspapers and local media that actually invested in doing local reporting. Now it's all national news, and everybody can kind of choose the
That's a different issue. That there was, and we have talked about that. There was a time when
there was one media. Voice.
Well, that there was media was so. There was just a limited amount of media, and there were no arguments over what facts were. And I know that we're in Southwest Michigan, but someone was talking to me once, a member of the Snyder administration, about the bridge controversy in Detroit. And he said, it used to be that when the Detroit News, the Detroit Free Press, and WJR, and the relevant personalities there agreed that something was a fact, it was a fact.
Well, and that's Walter Cronkite.
Walter Cronkite, yeah. Now we live in a media environment where everyone gets to also choose their own facts.
Who here still reads the paper? Yeah. Raise your hands. Yeah. Thank God. Myself, too.
Yeah.
But,
the, yeah.
Yeah. But you're still reading it.
Point zero, but that's 0.001%. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, do you read the paper or... do you read the articles that are posted by your connections on your
Facebook
feed?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll read the paper.
Yeah.
Just try to find state news in the paper or off the record. The last 2 weeks they've been dominated by national news. That's crap. We got all kinds of stuff going on.
I like you, man.
Rick just whispered in my ear, he's totally right.
You are.
And Rick was on last week's Off the Record. Hey, yeah, more questions, please.
We're in the 6th district, 6th congressional district, and you haven't mentioned the race between
Fred Upton and
I'm a little biased.
Paul Clemens.
Sure.
And Upton has not supported Donald Trump. He will not vote. He stated publicly he will not vote for Hillary Clinton, but he hasn't stated who he'll vote for.
He has not said how he will vote.
Congressman Upton is one of the last great moderate Republicans that you're going to find in service.
Moderate?
He's a centrist Republican. He does what's best for his district, and he does what's best for the country. He's
a
good man.
Will the top of the ticket affect him? His opponent is running an aggressive...
Probably impact him by some percentage points, but his name ID will probably, hopefully, in his ground game, carry him where he needs to be. But he is the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and that is a big position for this community. Understand that what he does, he's somebody that can work with Democrats and work with Republicans from here to there. I know he can't say it, but I will say it. He has a good bipartisan record. In terms of his service, and I find him to be one of the last of the good ones after my old boss, Dr. Schwartz, left.
The race that you're talking about is a rematch, and that Mr. Clement didn't win last time, and I just don't see it on anyone's list of swing races.
Well, I will say this,
and he's worked the district for a long time.
It's a tough seat, and I think Fred Upton was very smart not to get out in front of this Trump train. I think it would have been a very different race. Paul Clements is one of the smartest, most earnest, hardworking people I've ever met in politics. He is an incredibly good person. Right. It's just the district; it's tough. But I will tell you, this year. What happens at the debates? There's 22 days left. Donald Trump could. I don't know what he's going to do in the next 21 days, which could have a severe impact on the ticket. We've seen stranger things happen, and Paul is doing everything he can to put himself in a position to catch a win.
Every now and then there are those elections where the collapse on one side is so complete that it just changes things.
Numerically, it's difficult to do. I think they have better chances in the 7th and the 8th than they do in the 6th.
7th, 8th, and 1st are the swing seats in Michigan.
Okay.
If this was an open seat, I think it would be a very different situation this year. Kalamazoo County, as Matt said earlier, is trending Democratic. Swing. We have a lot of elections here. But it's going to be tough. But look, I wouldn't count Paul out, and we're working very hard to help him.
Okay.
Hi, I was just wondering, as one of the, split ballot voters that has been mentioned, I was wondering two parts of a question. First was, if there was one part of your party platform that you would change to appeal to a split ballot voter, what would it be?
Love that question.
And then the second part was, and I'll have egg on my face if there are none, but what, if any, proposals on the ballot would either of you two favor? And I'm guessing you saying
I got bad news for you on
yes.
the
so
last
Rick
one.
Will answer. Rick will answer the.
I know one that
the
Matt
last
would like to see
first.
On the ballot that didn't make it.
Yeah, no proposal.
I'll answer.
Although
I'll
Matt answer was that. Trying for.
Yeah,
one
I
of
mean,
the,
listen. Our company was involved in the legalization of recreational marijuana. We believe that it should be regulated properly and it should
Matt
be legal.
Matt will meet you behind the bar.
Again, Matt is looking for a place you know, to stay tonight.
I just yeah. Nah. You know what? The reality.
You got it about 1 o'clock.
The reality
o'clock,
of the yeah. matter is that marijuana and what it can bring from a tax base was not fixed in the legislation that was passed by the Michigan legislature recently. You have to look at the states like Colorado and Washington State and others. There are four others that are probably going to go legal. The reality is the prohibition on this plant is denying this state money and revenue for health care, public education, and public safety that should be available. So if you would have had a marijuana legalization ballot proposal on down ticket, you would have affected thousands of millennial voters, especially amongst the Bernie Sanders crowd, that would have turned out to vote because they had something else to vote for other than a president they didn't like. So I can tell you this, legalization of marijuana is coming soon to both the country and to into this state. And if you want to do it right, make sure that you put a proper regulation on it and make some revenue off of it and start paying for things that if you don't want to use it, you don't have to buy it, but there's still going to be a tax on it, and it's going to help things. To your point, what would I say about the Republican Party? Stop saying stupid shit.
So you're paraphrasing Barack Obama?
Let me would say we would put in our platform continue to say stupid, Jim. That would be the only thing.
Fair enough.
Okay, that was lovely. But I'm gonna totally like Diane Rehm you on this one because this is actually an amazing question, though. Seriously, though, real question, real answer from both of you. If there is one thing you could change in your party platform, what would it be other than saying stupid shit and then continuing to say stupid shit?
Well, I have
because I just find this question fascinating.
Okay, so
wait. I just need to jump in here because I'm the only person at this table who has not said stupid shit yet.
Well, I didn't actually say it. I have to be a little careful. You know, our party platform is determined by our platform committee. And actually this year we put a lot of things in there that have never been in there before. What I would personally think, I think we should be a little bit more aggressive and appealing to small business in talking about the benefits of small business owners and medium-sized business owners and having an agenda that separates them from some of the excesses of some of the bigger corporations that I think have really done some damage. So that would be my guess.
Yeah, fascinating. I think, no. I'm gonna, you know what, the fact that Brandon Dillon just said that I think is really fair because as chair, he is not even meant to say like 0.2 seconds off
the
radar
chair
of what he just
platform.
Said.
Yeah.
So,
I think Gary Peters has actually been, I mean, I don't think I'm off the reservation at the party. I think that, but we should be more aggressive in talking about the things that we want to do for small businesses, whether it's tax credits for hiring unemployed workers, whether it's investing in small businesses as opposed to give big tax cuts to big corporations. I think we need to move away and be smarter about how we talk about job creation and not lump everybody into the same boat when we're talking about the things we want to correct.
Great.
I think for us, that, and I'll probably be burned on the way home, but I think the Republican Party can continue to maintain its social conservative positions on social issues that are important to them. I think there should be less dialogue about that, and that it should be okay for a Republican to be a fiscal conservative and a socially centrist individual that may be a defense hawk or believe in less regulation, but I think that there's too much focus on social issues in terms of defining whether or not somebody is a rhino or whether or not they're a true Republican or whether or not...
Do you all know what a rhino is?
No.
Okay.
A Republican in name only. If you don't espouse the strict support of social issues in regards to gay marriage, abortion, all of these issues that are important to many of the base of this party, and that's why it's you know, bad to say, but I mean, if there's one thing that we could take a step back from and have a little less public discourse on and a little less focus on whether or not that's the criteria that makes you a good Republican or not, and let folks understand that there are Republicans that are fiscal conservatives, that are strong on defense, that are not really interested in making social issues a part of their overall platform and discourse.
So a Governor Rick Snyder.
Sure.
let's keep going to questions.
Hi, Patrick from Portage.
Hi, Patrick.
I've never been the recipient.
Love the alliteration.
Thank you. I've never been the recipient of a corporately endowed smartphone or email server, but my understanding is that implicit in the acceptance thereof, everything you do on that is the property of your employer. As the taxpaying citizen of Michigan, thereby the employer of every representative and governor of this state, not to mention Chris Christie, Governor Romney, Bush Jr., Hillary, across the board, how do we wrestle back the freedom of information? How do we get, how is our governor exempt from the Freedom of Information Act?
Can I jump in? Sure. Yeah. Well, because that was my bill when I was in the legislature, so I'm gonna jump all over this.
We're gonna go all to the bar.
Have
at it, man.
Well, to the house, I think it's
Brandon, Matt, Zoe, and I will meet you right now.
It's really crazy that Michigan is only one of two states that the governor and the legislature are exempt from FOIA. The House, because I think of public pressure and the Flint water crisis and others, has passed some FOIA reforms. My guess is it's going to die in the Senate. I don't think it's going to move. I introduced the bill when I found out that certain legislators' emails were FOIA-able because they had been included in a request to a county unit of government. And what they were saying in those emails was totally diametrically opposed to what they were saying publicly. So I do think we should have access to every elected official's email and correspondence, just like we do with local officials, township clerks. Michigan's one of only two states that does it. So I think the pressure is moving that way, and it's going to happen eventually. But, you know, legislators don't want to give up the privileges that they have, whether, you know, I was not a popular person for introducing that at the beginning. And I only had 7 co-sponsors. Out of 110. But I think now people are understanding that it has to be done.
Well, and you see someone like Brian Calley, who was in the state legislature, who was a huge proponent of the idea of changing some of these, and then is part of an administration and suddenly isn't able to get quite behind it or has to step back a little bit from pushing for that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the standard should be, and we tell this to candidates, if you don't want something to appear on the front page of the newspaper or on a website,
don't send it.
Don't say it. Don't do it. And I was always had people said, well, why don't you release your emails? I said, they're going to be very, very boring because I never got any bills passed. And most of the times constituents were just complaining about getting their streets plowed. So I think people should understand, especially with WikiLeaks and all these things, that you should be very careful about the things you say. And if you're not willing to say it in public, don't write it down in private.
Right.
Well, it's not a right that you ever actually had because technology is changing
the way
that people communicate.
But I think the right you're talking about is that we our tax dollars are paying for their salaries. But let's also talk about that some of our tax dollars are paying for school teachers. And for, I mean, just because our tax dollars are going to someone's job doesn't mean that they shouldn't be able to get a level of privacy. I think the argument is the idea that when there are nefarious things, we feel like we should know about them. But there's a line there about having privacy in our communication, no? Yeah. No,
you're delving into a very complicated realm, which is that we have public meetings for a reason. And so if we were a city council and we have these microphones, the idea is that the public is hearing everything that we're hearing, unless some of us pick up these and start texting each other. And some of it might be personal. Some of it might be...
Yeah, I know. I totally feel the same way about that guy on the left.
Yeah. You know, that. And we... As a society and a political culture have not figured out, and we need to. This is really important to me. I mean, this is my job. How we're going to sort through the private versus the public issues. That someone should not be allowed to pick up one of these and say and send a text to someone else in a public forum. I'm going to vote yes or no, and here is why.
If they're paying for it themselves. though. If that cell phone bill is paid out of Rick Pluta's checking account.
That's a very fair point. And there is also nothing, you know, from stopping someone from walking over to someone else on the floor of the Michigan House of Representatives and writing a handwritten note or just whispering in their ear, here's why we're doing it. That the nature of communication has changed, but the fact that there are private and public communications has not.
I love FOIA requests. I mean, that's how we get half of our data. I mean, we have to FOIA the Secretary of State's office to receive the voter records. Those voter records come across to us looking like some IBM 1988 spreadsheet that I can't absolutely read, and you have to spend $173,000 to build a software platform that can actually translate the 1980 platform into tangible data that can be read in an Excel sheet. But the point is,
I understood everything he just said.
You pay for those FOIA requests. You know, there's a cost to that as a consumer or as a citizen. You have to pay a certain amount of money to FOIA that. And I will be bluntly honest and say, listen, there are some things in government, like it's the making the sausage. You know what? You don't want to know. You don't need to know necessarily unless it's nefarious. If you were to FOIA every single email of every single state representative, do you know the reams of paper that it would be of just mindless, you know, hey, did you...
Actually, one of the ways that people get around, one of the ways that government agencies and elected officials get around FOIAs is that they give you everything.
Right. That's called a data dump.
It's called a data dump, and there's no way that you could sort through all of it.
Although, I mean, look, we're all laughing, and it's funny, and it's ha-ha, but, I mean, some of the most important information of the past year has come from those FOIA requests. I mean, coming from, I know I keep throwing this
and
out,
from,
but it's something
and
where...
And from the governor's office trying to get in front of what might be FOIA.
Well, this is what I'm going to say, is that one of the issues, again, that Michigan Radio dealt with was the Flint water crisis and how we found out a lot of this information was through FOIA and spending tens of thousands of dollars on requests. Not quite sure whether those, you know, huge amounts for public radio was going to end up with anything. And then having, you know, a dump of 76,000 emails that, you know, four people were supposed to go through over, you know, in a 24-hour period and try to just hope that there was something there.
Okay, let's get in some more questions.
I have three. I'm Marilee from Kalamazoo. Sorry. I have three questions, actually. One is, what is the status of the court thing on the straight ticket voting? Second, I'd like to hear your thoughts on what you think is the reason that for the rise of Trump, and what is the what do you think the future of the Republican Party is?
I will answer the first one.
Thank you. I'll do the first two, and then I'll leave the other one to Matt. The status.
My chair is taking over.
The status of the straight party balloting is a federal judge put a temporary injunction on implementation of the elimination of it. The Supreme Court upheld that. It will go to trial next year on whether or not it's a violation of the Voting Rights Act. So we'll see what this...
You will be allowed to vote straight ticket this year.
This year. Exactly. You can vote straight ticket this year. The rise of Trump, look, I'll be very honest. I think it's a little bit disingenuous for certain Republicans to now distance themselves from Trump when for many, many years they have sown the seeds of the environment that has produced Donald Trump. For years it was kind of dog whistle politics about race, about social issues, and Donald Trump, I think, picked up where Sarah Palin left off and took it and just said, I am going full on, and I'm going to talk about these issues in a way that really excites a certain portion of the Republican base that has been told that the reason that they're not doing well is because of immigrants, gays, guns, all sorts of things. And I think, you know, frankly, the Republican Party will have to reckon with this for many years to come, because Donald Trump didn't just fall out of the sky. The primary voters have been conditioned to be willing to accept something
like
this
for
a long time.
Except that Donald Trump never won a majority of Republican primary voters.
Well, if you look at what Republican elected officials now are doing, they're calculating whether or not they want to disavow Donald Trump or stay with him. And many of them are making the calculation that if they disavow him, they are going to get punished by their base voters. So I think they have no one to blame but themselves for this.
Yeah.
Matt, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah.
Not really.
All right, let's get to another question.
Okay, we've got time for maybe two more questions.
Yeah, actually you do.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Okay, so I'm sorry, because I really like Matt. I didn't mean to. I wanted to hear what he had to
say. Actually, I wanted to say something about questions 2 and 3 from the last guy who asked the question, woman.
From Marilee. Uh-huh.
Okay, so what was the second question?
What is your question?
Oh, well, okay. The third question was the future of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so at some point in the future, and I noticed there aren't a lot of colored people of color here tonight, at some point, primarily white people will not be the majority. So how does that weigh into the future of the Republican
Party? We will be a majority-minority country. There will be no majority.
Yeah.
Ethnic majority.
Right. So that's the one question. And then
what is the question?
The question is, how will that, when white people are no longer a majority, how will that affect the Republican Party? Yeah.
Well, I think that
you mean in terms of issues or voting?
Yeah. Voting. Both.
Well, I think that... I'll take a stab at this.
Well, okay, what will it do to the Republic? How will the Republican Party change to try and compensate for that?
Do you mean how will Republicans, if there's fewer white people voting Republican, how will they find other voters?
Let's let Matt take a stab.
I don't understand the question.
Well, I guess...
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
Okay.
Let me jump in. I'm going to throw you a lifeline. This is like who wants to be a millionaire.
Or phone a friend.
I think the question you're asking is actually, I think I know what you're getting at.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm not getting
the kind of,
question.
People saying that the Republican Party is going to fracture and be irrelevant are just crazy. I mean, it will, the Republican Party will survive.
It has to evolve.
It will change. Just like the Democratic Party changed after 1964 and embraced a much more strong platform on civil rights and being the party of engaging with people of color as opposed to having a base in the South, they will evolve. It's going to be a challenge, I think, for a while for them to be able to do it. But again, getting back to that one of those first questions, the two-party system is... Essentially, this is where the benefits are. It essentially provides stability. The parties will change because the parties have to adapt in order to succeed.
Okay. Oh, and I
hope it takes them a long time to do that, but they will eventually.
Just to clarify, I wasn't getting at anything. I'm primarily Democrat, but
I know what you were saying.
I think one of the questions that we're having is just, and particularly with race being such a factor, is just when we say things like, well, how are the whites going to vote? How are blacks going to vote? How are women going to vote? I mean, exactly. And so these are the questions that we have today about when we talk about how folks are going to vote. So no, I want everyone to ask questions. Yeah.
Trump, how Trump happened, I think it was the Republican Party looking for a hero in the wrong place.
But they wanted Marco Rubio to be the hero.
But also remember, you had a, 17?
Let's get in a couple more
17-person
questions.
Primary divides a lot of votes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I think we have time for one more.
So I, like a lot of people in here, are looking.
You're wearing a Cubs shirt. You're an optimist.
Go Cubbies. That's right. So I'm a millennial. I'm an optimist.
Yes.
We're in Southwest Michigan. I mean, that's Cubs.
And you're
Cubs
all about the Michigan radio issues now.
I am. My second time here.
It is.
So my question is, I'm looking forward to November 9th, but given what we've just experienced at the federal level over the last 8 years, what prospect do we have of any compromise, any sort of functioning federal government? Mm. After this general election.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that depends on how much on the federal level, what seats swing. I know that the Republicans are concerned about at least 2 seats in California that would not normally be in play, the Yoder seat, I think, and another one there. And does the House shift? at the national level. And, you know, there's one thing I can say I'm positive about the Clintons is that they have always been very good at working together with the folks in the leadership positions, as long as those people are open to working with them. And that has to be a part of the changes that we've talked about with the Republican Party, is that there needs to be a little bit less rigidity and a little bit more willingness to give a compromise, like Tip O'Neill back in the day, and say, hey, I can give a bit here and there. And I guess it remains to be seen, but if it is Hillary, then does she able to bridge that gap? And does Paul Ryan, if he's still the majority leader, or if not, are people going to be willing to work together? And that's really the reality of what needs to be more focused on in politics today.
You know, in a way, what you're saying is that government that in a democracy, government thrives on inconsistency.
That's heavy, man. I think I just went back to my 1993 philosophy class at Michigan State.
Whoa, man, let's all just take a minute and let that just...
Very, very deep.
Let that sit in. I was just going to say, I think
Jack Handy just came in with deep thoughts.
Like the last presidential debate where we were all saying something nice about the other party. It's like, I don't know, his kids are great, I guess. Brandon, November 9th.
I can't wait. It's going to be a very nice. I'm going to take a vacation in my basement for a couple weeks. I'm not talking to anybody.
You're going to go to Disneyland?
No, I'm going to my basement. I'm not talking to anybody. So, but it is... Again, but I would say on a little serious note, it's really the systemic changes that need to happen. It's not the personalities. It's the fact that people's points of reference are appealing to their base, getting big money out of politics. Some of these systemic changes are really what it's going to be needed for good people to be able to do good things without getting punished.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, let's leave it on that because that's such a happy note. Okay.
Thank you. Brandon Dillon, State Democratic Party Chair. Matt Marsden, Rev 6 CEO and numbers master.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. Let's see, Steve, is there anything you wanna throw out there? Yeah.
Applause again for the folks here at One Well Brewing for hosting
yes,
us tonight.
Yes.
Tip the wait staff. Have a beer
Thank
before you go.
Thank you for letting us Drive take carefully. Over your home. Thank you, everyone. And Rick and I will be here for a little bit. Maybe Matt and Brandon can stay for a little bit, too, if you have any extra questions or anything like that. We'd be happy to answer. Okay. Thanks, everybody.